in the forest monasteries of northeast Thailand, when we have major ceremonies, like Katina, for instance, the tradition is that there will be Dhamma talks right through the night from about 8 or 9 after evening chanting through till 5 o'clock in the morning. And as you can imagine, most by the time it gets to about 1 or 2 in the morning, everybody gets very sleepy. And so that's the time when they invite the Western monk to give the talk. And I think probably straight after lunch is somewhat comparable to 2 o'clock in the morning. some time ago I was giving a Dhamma talk which I illustrated with a story, and the person listening sat rather impassively, and then afterwards he said, "Yes, I read that story in one of your books, and I think it was better in the book." As the book that you all have on your lap contains transcriptions of some conversations on the subject of Buddhist education, I don't want to be reproducing in an inferior form something that you already have in front of you. So I'll try to speak about something which is hopefully fresh and useful to you, and offer some reflections on becoming a teacher, being a teacher, the challenges of being a teacher, perhaps some humble reflections and suggestions. My first real insight on this, I can say, was after being with my teacher Ajahn Chah for a month or so. It was New Year's Eve, 1978. And there were thousands of people came to see in the new year. And Ajahn Chah was sitting in the midst of the Sangha, surrounded by perhaps 200 monks and novices. And there were hundreds of white nuns sitting in front of him. And after giving a very inspiring Dhamma talk, he was sitting there in the midst of the Sangha when suddenly there was a bit of a commotion at the back. And then a monk walked onto the raised seat where the Sangha was sitting. And he was an old monk, and obviously from a monastery in the city, and he wasn't very well robed. He didn't look very inspiring, at least to my eyes. And what really impressed me was that immediately Ajahn Chah got up from his seat and very politely showed this monk to his own seat, and then led all the Sangha in bowing in a very beautiful way to this strange monk that nobody knew. All they knew was that he'd been a monk longer than Ajahn Chah, and that was enough to guarantee him that kind of respect. So the beauty of the ceremony was for me enhanced by this sense of Sangha, and this sense that Ajahn Chah wasn't in any way investing in this position as being the great teacher, surrounded by his disciples and thousands of people who loved him and respected him. But for him, it was the Dhamma and the Vinaya that was his teacher, and he was in no way lost in or indulging in what for most people were conditions which might well have given rise to such feelings. Now, many years later, when Ajahn Chah became seriously ill, bedridden, paralyzed, his successor, this monk who's now still the abbot of Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, his name is Ajahn Liam, or he's now a Lumpur himself, Lumpur Liam. And what I loved about Lumpur Liam was that he was always exactly who he was. I think you can perhaps imagine the pressure on Ajahn Liam to be Ajahn Chah Mark II, and to be as charming, as articulate, as inspiring, as charismatic, as a magnetic personality as Ajahn Chah. And he's not that kind of person, at least he wasn't then. And that wasn't really the point which inspired me. It was the fact that he was quite happy to be who he was. And aware that there was so much pressure on him from so many people to be like Ajahn Chah, and he didn't succumb to that. He was him. He was Ajahn Liam. And now, many years on, he has his own following, and people are probably feeling somewhat intimidated about filling in his footsteps in one day. So this is an observation, a thought about being a teacher, that you don't have to be any particular kind of teacher. And particularly when the Dhamma is disseminated by lay teachers, I think that sometimes too much emphasis can be given on Dhamma talks and how good talks people give. And that's not really the essence of being a teacher. And we don't want sort of comparisons and competition between teachers, who gives the best talks, who tells the best stories, who has the funniest jokes. That's nothing to do with the transmission of Dhamma, and it is only, and it's very little to do with being a good teacher. So I think it's more important that we're constantly looking at ourselves very clearly and very willing to always be a student. And at Tosi School and in Thailand, this is something that I stress a lot. The word aseka, which means someone who's graduated, someone who has no longer need to study, is a word kept for arahants. So everyone who's not yet an arahant, which I imagine is most of us here today, are still students. And so even if you've been a teacher like myself for many years, I'm a student. And at the school, I say, we have three different kinds of student in the school. We have the children, they're students quite clearly, and then we have the teachers who are students, and the parents who are students. And we all need to be following the same path of study and willing to learn from our mistakes. And I think that for us as teachers, one good test of yourself is to ask, can you say to a question, I don't know? Can you say, I got it wrong? Can you admit that you made mistakes? So it's not, I don't think that anybody expects you to be perfect and to be enlightened, but it's much more important to be honest and to be willing to maintain this ideal of being a student. There was one great Chinese monk who left the home life at the age of 60, having been very successful in his lay life. And he made a determination as he set off walking through the Chinese countryside. He said, if I meet someone who is older than me, but that I know more than him, I will share what I know with that person, whoever it may be. But if I meet someone, even a child of 7, if he knows more than me, I will seek to learn from that person. And that's the kind of attitude that you lead. If as a teacher you think that part of being a teacher means that you must be infallible, that you must have all the answers, and that it's losing faith and you're losing respect and your position if you admit that there are certain things that you don't know, then this is a danger for you. So being very, very humble. And for myself, I constantly return to one of the very simple teachings of the Buddha. So more as I spend more and more time in the holy life, The teachings that I come back to with real delight are often the most simple and basic teachings rather than the really kind of complex and profound ones. And one of those teachings is the importance of gratitude, and gratitude as being a sign or a characteristic of a sage. So for myself, if I meet anyone who's well known as a teacher, writes great books, gives great talks, but hopefully doesn't, but sometimes does denigrate their own teacher, or ignores them, or ignores the debt of gratitude that they owe to their teachers, there's a certain sense of mistrust arises in my mind. For myself, I look at my own life, at least, and if I can see good qualities there, I immediately think of my mother, my father, and my teachers. And I know very well that without them, those good qualities in myself wouldn't be present. Or if I can look beyond that, then I'm looking at good karma that's been created in the past life and perhaps the present life also. It's a recognition of karma, good karma, the power or the potential of karma, rather than me and myself. And I think as teachers, one point that was brought up this morning was how do we position ourselves in as teachers in the modern world with the consumerism and materialism and so on. And I think that we are Buddhasasana, this is the religion which we take wisdom as the primary virtue rather than faith. So we have the role of providing a mirror and reflections to the Sangha at large, to the society at large, encouraging people to look again, to look clearly, and giving people tools to be able to look for themselves and to become refuges unto themselves. So the paradigm of the teacher then is of the doctor. If you're a good doctor, you don't want someone to be your patient or your life. Well, some very greedy doctors might think that, but an ethical doctor wants the patient to get better. And if you notice teachers trying to create very strong personal bonds and emphasizing and stressing means and structures which will promote themselves as individuals, this again is something to be wary of, and as a teacher himself, to be careful of that. So one aspect of modern culture which I think we have to be very careful not to buy into is the cult of celebrity. We've talked this morning somewhat about the message and the messenger and so on. But for me, we're not a messenger. I'm a vessel, or perhaps stained glass, like a stained glass window. But it's not important. Just now, I don't think very many people made very much out of the plates that they ate the meal off of. It's the food that's more interesting. So the teacher, just the plate, or is the stained glass window, so the light comes through, and there, it does take on a certain tinge through the personality of the Dhamma teacher, but it shouldn't be anything more than that. And we shouldn't be creating structures which are feeding into that whole very dangerous cult of celebrity which has taken over the whole world just now. So we don't want teacher as celebrity. We want teacher as the vessel for the teachings. But what we do want in teachers, I think, are people who are practicing what they preach. Now, although Ajahn Chah's teachings have been transcribed, have been translated, and many people have derived great benefit from them, having lived with him myself and having also had the good fortune to spend time with other great teachers, I would say that often the most memorable exchanges and teachings that I've received from them have not been teaching specific to them, but they've just voiced teachings that I'd heard many times before, read many times before. But that teaching, sometimes a very simple teaching, went straight to my heart because of this absolute certainty that he was talking from his own experience. And it was coming from his heart, not something that he'd just memorized or been teaching over many years. So it's not just what you teach, it's who you are. But that doesn't mean that you have to be somebody special. Just be you, like Ajahn Liam, Lumpur Liam, and be sincere about your failings, that you're also a student, that you're sharing what you know to your friends. You're trying to be a good friend, the Kalyana Mitta. And so in the Buddhist community, we should be trying to create this culture and this society of Kalyana Mittata, to be good friends to each other. So what we don't want are teachers who are praising their own style, praising their own technique, and criticizing others. Only this is right, everybody else is wrong. Or, yeah, they're quite good, but it's not the real, this is the real thing. And that kind of divisive speech is the way in which teachers can create some very bad karma. So when you become a teacher, it's like to add on to Mr. Vijaya's inappropriate simile this morning, it's like gambling with high stakes. It means the opportunity for you to make a great deal of good karma is there, but you can also make a great deal of bad karma. So if you're speaking derisively or you're putting down other teachers, other traditions who are in their own way teaching the Four Noble Truths, it's not that they're teaching some kind of deviant teaching which will lead people off the middle path, but just a slightly different emphasis. I mean, how much ink has been spilt, how many arguments over the relative importance of samatha and vipassana, for instance. I mean, that's somewhat depressing, that we should be willing to waste so much time over those kinds of arguments. So we need a mudita to really be able to appreciate all the good things that are going on. Like, mudita is the express way to nibbana. It's just so easy. You don't have to do anything. You just sit there and appreciate all the good things everyone else is doing. It's really enjoyable, and it has a wonderful effect on you. So don't be picking holes in each other. We're all, and to use another simile this morning from Venerable, we're all on the same team. And so it's not a competition. We all have our own gifts and things that we can offer. And this morning, there were some wonderful things said and some wonderful things happened. And just to recap for you, Bhanteji started talking about the Buddha's biography, and he referred to Prince Siddhartha as silly on a number of occasions, and he said he made many silly comments. And what was wonderful was not just that he said that. I mean, when you're 80 years old and you've been in the Sangha so long, you can get away with anything. It wasn't just that he said that, but that everybody laughed and enjoyed it. I mean, I think in certain religious traditions, which will remain nameless, many people would have walked out at that point, or maybe shouted at him, "You're going to fall into hell." And it would have been a kind of a major shock to the whole meeting. But that didn't happen at all. What happened was, if there was a sense of shock, but I think most of us thought, "Wow, yes, I never really thought about that. That's interesting. What are the implications of that to my life as a teacher and how we teach?" And so when the questions came up, that was the tone of the questions, wasn't it? So we have this this inquiring mind, and we don't have to hold on very tightly to particular presentations of the Dhamma. We are at least even if we don't agree with new interpretations completely, we, as Buddhists, we're willing to, yes, let me look at that, let me think through that. So that was really wonderful. I have my own comment on this, by the way, and that is that it's important to distinguish Buddhism from the faith-based religions, the belief systems. As Bhante also mentioned in the Encyclopedia of Religion, they give you 10 definitions of religion, all based on the idea that religion is a belief system. So Buddhism doesn't fit into that because Buddhism is an education system. It's not a belief system. It's a radically different kind of religion. And that being so, the attitude to historical events is different. Now, if you were to prove, say through some archaeological evidence or so on, that certain key events in, say, the life of Jesus didn't actually happen, Christianity would find it very hard to survive that because it is a historical religion. The events in Jesus' life are absolutely central to the Christian message. Whereas as Buddhists, we can agree the baby Jesus was born and walked 7 steps. You can believe that if you like. You don't believe it, it's all right. You can believe about that he went on this chariot ride and didn't know what an old man was. It's all right. You know, you can believe it or not. The question is, what do you do with that? Does it lead to an increase in faith and effort and mindfulness and samadhi and wisdom, or a decrease? The weakness, I think, throughout, if I may say, not just in Malaysia, in Thailand, in so many areas of the Buddhist world, is that there's no clear-cut distinction between primary and secondary sources when we're relating these stories. And it's all mixed together. And all we need to know is what is actually in the sutta. What do we know comes directly from the Buddha? What came afterwards? What's commentarial? And we can see that there's no... Bhante himself is a modern-day commentator on the suttas. And there's no intrinsic reason why we should give more weight to commentators 1,000 years ago than we give to Bhanteji, because they're both very senior, learned, practiced, well-practiced monks, trying to make efforts to make the teachings applicable to an audience and to a Buddhist community. But when there's no distinction made between primary and secondary source and commentary on sub-commentary, it's all just mixed up into one, then Buddhist tradition makes itself vulnerable to this kind of criticism that he was relating. So I think we can make use of myth and legend, and it's wonderful. I mean, I love those stories. I wouldn't like to throw them out. But recognizing them as stories and saying, this is a story, and this is why we tell this story. We don't really know whether it happened or not. Probably it didn't. But this is why our great teachers of the past have told these stories. So I think that we can make use of those stories as we make clear these are stories. These are stories that we've made up. This is how, in the past, great teachers have filled in between the lines. So if we may want to carry that on or not, that's another question. But seeing that we must distinguish between what's Buddha Vajana and what is not. So we don't say we're going to throw out the commentaries, but recognizing commentaries as commentaries, and they are the results of the work of great monks in throughout the ages. Excuse me. How much longer have I got? 5, 10 minutes. Okay, time bound. So many things to talk about, aren't there? As teachers, let's say, I think that we're approaching the point in Malaysia where, you know, I've spoken to Brother Dan about this, that there needs to be some clear-cut ethical standards for for teachers. So this is a few things I'm going to just throw out there for you to discuss. As a monk, I have the vinaya as a protection. The vinaya, the discipline of a monk, provides many functions. It creates harmony in the monastic order. It is a base for development of mindfulness, but it is also a protection. And, for instance, I have certain training rules which prevent me from being alone with a woman, for speaking more than six sentences alone with a woman, and so on. And as long as I or any other monk keeps those kinds of rules, then scandals can't happen. So if you would imagine, you know, a series of concentric walls with the very heavy, the most weighty kinds of rules on the inside, and then the outer perimeter of this wall being the minor rules of training, then you can be confident if you can maintain the security of the outer wall, you don't have to worry about the inner wall. So if monks maintain the minor rules of training, they don't have to worry about the expulsion offences. So if a monk is never alone with a woman and doesn't speak alone with a woman, doesn't have long conversations alone with a woman, then you can say it's impossible that any major sexual scandals are going to arise. Now, for lay teachers, you don't have those same kind of clear-cut protections for you. But if you're in any kind of position of power and authority, you have any kind of charisma, you are going to inspire people, and you're often going to bring up feelings of love and infatuation in members of the opposite sex, and you need some protection for that. And this is something that I would suggest as teachers, that you get together and you talk about some ethical guidelines for teachers, particularly in the area of relations to the opposite sex, and the area of money and power. Power is an important one, and power is a difficult one in that it can creep up on you. And I've seen many people just change into almost different people altogether when they start to get some power and acclaim. And the Buddha was constantly warning the bhikkhus that don't think that fame and gain, all these things are sweet things. They're bitter. They're dangerous things for you as a monk. So my time is running out. The suggestion I have is that for those of you who are in teaching positions, you get together and you talk about ethical guidelines and having something written down that you can post up in your centers, and so that your students can also feel some protection. The other point is that my belief is that the Buddhasasana only really becomes firmly established in a country when there is a firm monastic order. I would like to encourage you to find ways to promote the monastic order. And also for those of you particularly in teaching positions, I would suggest that it would be a very good thing for you all to become monks at some time in your teaching career. I'm not, husbands and wives of teachers, relax. I'm not suggesting that they leave their home life altogether, but to spend some period of time as a monastic in your teaching career. In Thailand, the traditional period would be 3 months, to spend 3 months rains retreat as a bhikkhu or as a bhikkhuni or as a nun or whatever, to have a full understanding of what it means to be the inheritor of the Sakyamuni Buddhas, the Gautama Buddhas, sasana. It's just such a wonderful feeling to wear this robe, and this is the very same robe that the Sariputra Moggallana and all the great monks wore. And this is an unbroken tradition from the great Savakas, that keeping the very same rules, the same discipline that those monks gave. Go on arms round in the morning and receiving food from the lay people in the very same way that the great Savakas did. So it's just such a wonderful feeling. And that's just the beginning. You know, not yet into the actual study and the ability and the time to devote yourself to practice without all the worries and the hassles of the home life. So this would be my second recommendation for people to consider, those of you in teaching positions, to consider taking at least temporary ordination at some time. So in the end, whether we're monastics, lay Buddhists, whatever our role may be, we're all both students and we're all teachers as well. We all have things that we can share with each other. So there's no kind of fixed division here between teachers and students. We're all students and we can all in our own ways be teachers. And we're all following the Eightfold Path. There's not one Eightfold Path for monks and one Eightfold Path for lay people. We're all following the same path. And so we need a roadmap for this. We need to be able to find what is the most appropriate way that we can develop sila and samadhi and panya, and what's the best way that we can adapt those principles of development, external and internal development, for our students. So what we're ultimately seeking for is the cessation of all dukkha. So in the Middle East and other areas of conflict, they get together and they discuss how to develop a roadmap. So as Buddhists, all of us need to get together and develop our Nirodha map. So that's the end of my talk for today.